Support for Soundwaves from the Underground is brought to you by 24tix.com, the most convenient way to buy tickets to your favorite local concerts. Save time, save money, rock out. 24tix.com, your ticket to the experience.
Hey, this is Slug Magazine. My name's JP.
I'm JP too.
And we're recording Soundwaves from the Underground. We're taking over the airwaves.
This is like that movie with the boat, Titanic.
I'm JP, and this is another edition of Soundwaves from the Underground, the official podcast of Slug Magazine in Salt Lake City, Utah. Slug is an acronym for Salt Lake Underground, and we're one of the oldest independent publications in the U.S. distributing free monthly issues about music, art, action sports, subculture. We'll have an occasional beer review or two, and we also cover local and national CD releases and much more. On this episode, we're going to be speaking with the local band Thunderfist, finding out about the latest music from Cannibal Corpse, and getting more information about PETA. Thunderfist is a rock and roll band from Salt Lake City that started up in 1998. The band jokingly states that they formed simply to keep themselves interesting to the ladies. They've gone through several lineup changes and hiatuses, but continue to reunite and put out new music periodically. Thunderfist currently consists of Mike Mayo, Eric Stevens, Jeff Haskins, Mike Sasich, Jeremy Cardenas, and Matt Miller. During a 12-year run, the band have released 5 full-length albums, including 2005's live album recorded at Burt's Tiki Lounge. Their most recent is self-titled and was released in February of this year. I'd like to quote your bio, if I may, guys, to start out. It says, "All of our undergarments are torn and dirty from too many nights of rock and roll in pretty much every shitty dive bar in North America and one in Mexico. Thank you, Sammy Hagar."
Yep.
And then a ha-ha. And I should mention that I'm joined right now by Jeremy and Eric.
That's right.
Thanks, guys.
Hey, how you doing?
I have a quick question about that. Are we to understand that you played at the infamous Cabo Wabo Cantina?
No, actually what happened was, on my honeymoon, I played next to the Cabo Wabo with a Mexican cover band for an entire night, and I figured I represented the entire band very well. I got drunked up on tequila, and I sang 3 AC/DC songs, and then that turned into 10 songs, and we were doing Rolling Stones and Creedence and everything else, and it attracted a pretty good crowd, you know, so I just made a joke about I was next to Cabo Wabo one time. And I walked into it for a minute to use the bathroom because the bathroom at the little taco stand weird bar next door was really shitty. So that's where that came from.
That's a pretty good story. No pun intended, by the way, on the shitty, right?
Yeah, no pun intended.
Of course, thank you. You guys have been around for a long time.
Yep.
How would you say your sound has changed or evolved over the years?
I think it's just an evolution of technique. Basically, mm-hmm. Everyone's gotten a little better. We've gotten stronger. We have an intrinsic knowledge of each other. Like, Eric and I were the original members. He knows what I want to do, and I can explain to... A lot of times, we can just explain to without even talking to one another. We can just do what we have to do. Musically, we have some really great players. I mean, bringing on Matt Miller and Sasich and Mayo, those three guys are a really good core of strong musicians that can play off of one another as well. And it's really great to have such good guitar players. And, you know, I started out and I write songs, Mike writes songs. We all do. We all interject something into the mix. But I think the songwriting thing has gotten stronger and we're getting better as we're older. We're a little more in tune with one another and we perform really well together. So all in all, it's just made it a good run. You know, like that many years together, we're like brothers. And we can sit there and not talk we can talk or not talk. We can talk about soup. So that reminded me of. But, you know, like that's it. But that's what it boils down to. Like, we know each other well enough that we don't have to communicate a lot of things that new bands have to fight through with personalities and things like that.
12 years is a long time, and it was a long time ago when you formed. Do you remember how that happened, Eric? The conversation where you and Jeremy were talking?
Yeah, I just remember one night I was playing this shitty little band downtown, and he just walks in and says, "I want you to be in my band." And I was like, "Oh, really?" Hand me a record, and I loved it. It's just a fast, quirky punk rock record, and I thought it was hilarious.
That wasn't Thunderfist at that point, though, Jeremy,
Yeah, it was, yeah. And what had happened was I was in another band, a local band, and our guitar player had died, and we were kind of in a limbo, and I needed something to do that was energetic. And you can see it, and it's incorporated in what we do. I have a love of punk rock. I have a love of rock and roll, like classic rock and roll. Good sense of humor and love bands like the Dwarves and Nashville Pussy, where everything's really tongue-in-cheek and you know, you're just taking the piss out of everything all the time. And so when I saw Eric's a really, really solid, really phenomenally grounded drummer, and he bangs the shit out of the drums, and I like that. And so when I saw him, he practiced in the same space as me. It was like, I gotta get this guy to play with me. And it's worked out really well, because he is. And just anything you throw at him, he can adapt to and overcome. And because we bitch at him all the time about what beat we want, you know, and what rhythm we want. And we want you to swing this, but we want this straightforward, and we want, you know, and all that. And we challenge him a lot. But that's good to do, right? We get it,
yeah.
You know. I mean, we're linear, but we grow in different areas. We, you know, we have a linear sound, and if you've seen us in 98 versus now, there's still an energy. That energy's still there. I'm 100 years old now, but that 20-year-old energy's still there, you know? Like, and that's good. We've bashed our heads in at Bert's Tiki Lounge enough nights. We've bashed our heads in a lot of shitty places, and I think it's good for you. It builds character. Well,
right.
In a way it does. You know, it's kind of like it's a weird character. It makes you steal to everything, but it also makes you realize how good you have it to be able to stick with your friends for that long, or be able to get acknowledgement and recognition in your own city. You know, when we have a show, it's usually pretty well populated, and we have a lot of folks there, and they're friends. It's not like just folks coming to see whatever thing has gone on for the moment. It's like people that, I know these people, I know every person out there, and I probably have a story about them, that I've been drunk with them or at their house, or, you know, or chased them around or whatever, you know, and I like that a lot, and that's kind of a cool thing. And
yeah.
We love this town, so.
A lot of history in Salt Lake City. I was doing a profile on the heavy metal shop in Kevin, and I asked him a few years ago, you know, what's one of your top sellers, and he pointed at the Thunderfist album, Too Fat for Love, and he's like, this one always. So you've got a lot of support there. That must feel good in the community.
Oh yeah, man, it's great. You know, with Kevin, with Brad at Raunch, there are a lot of folks that just, like, especially with those two, and Kevin I'm really close to. I do sound at the heavy metal shop when he does his in-stores and things like that. But, you know, love those guys, and like I said, we're big proponents of the Salt Lake City, and I love when there's new talent and there's creativity going on here, because the image that people have a lot of times is so skewed and ridiculous, because a lot of ridiculous shit comes out of here, and there's so much talent and so many really great people here that you have to kind of remind them of that, you know, a little bit, and let them know that we're not all kooks. I mean, we're kooky, but not in a bad way, I guess you could say.
I would say not in a bad way. I'd like to talk a little bit about the new album, if we may. How does it feel to have a new release under your belt, Eric?
Feels great, man. It's been a couple of years, so we really put a lot of time and effort into this. I think it turned out great. I think it's our best record to date.
Really strong. And we did record it twice.
I was wondering why. How'd that happen? Explain, please.
It was a drum sound thing. When we got it done, we're really lucky because we have Mike Sasich in the band, and he has his own recording studio. So when we recorded, we can get the sounds we want. Every album we've ever done, we've been rushed. We have 72 hours to get all the rhythm stuff done, and then 24 hours to get all the lead stuff done and vocals, and then we have to mix it and get it done before we get out of there. We've worked with Jack Endino a few times, and that's great because he's a great guy. I'd love to have a month with Jack to be able to make an album, because it'd be enormous, you know? But we always have this compact time, and he always works with us and does that Jack voice. It's like, oh, I'll just mix it and send you guys. Don't worry about it. I'll do it on my own time, you know, kind of thing, and that's great. But with Sasich, we got to sit down and just do stuff. I got to sing, not just yell stuff. It was really weird for me to go in and sing a song. I'm so used to just kind of bashing my brains out and screaming all the time. And it's like, okay, I'm going to sing some songs and find voices. Mike Mayo got to find a voice, you know, instead of, you know, he's evolved vocally that way as well. And it was really nice to be able to have time to do that, you know, so.
That shows in the new album, yeah. You guys had some serious time to think about that, and I've got a question about the album, specifically the lyrics behind the track number 5, okay. Eskimo Pussy is Mighty Cold.
Yeah.
Who's the lyricist in that?
Me.
Was that you? Yeah. I wanted to quote that. I don't know, but I've been told Eskimo Pussy is Mighty Cold.
Yeah.
Such poetry begs the question, who told you guys this?
Well,
you've been told that, right? Where
well,
from?
When I was young, from 18 to 23, I was in the Army, and I was stationed in Alaska. And so, Full Metal Jacket,
yeah.
That's one of their cadences, a Marine cadence that they sing.
Oh, right.
And so, when I was up in Alaska, I dated a girl, and that's who it ended up being about, that she broke my heart, she ruined me. She was a stripper. I thought she was a cocktail waitress. She was a stripper. She was polishing all of my friends' zippers.
Classic.
And they weren't telling me. They were kind of holding it back because they thought it was funny. And so when I finally, you know, it kind of, I have these weird manifestations. And when we were doing the music behind it, I was sitting in the booth and I just started saying that, and it worked out, you know, and the cadence worked out with the lyrics worked out with, and I kind of hit it and put a little, just kind of hit it behind a wall of, you know, a little wall of noise, and I kind of hit the vocals a little bit in the back, but But it worked out, and it turned out pretty good. And it's a good, fitting tribute to her, you filthy, filthy whore. So
tell us what you really think, right? No, I heard that in the song. I was wondering what that was about. What has Matt Miller added to Thunderfist's sound, especially in recording the new album, would you say?
A huge beard, a lot of hair. He looks like Zakk Wylde.
You can play with a beard. A lot of people don't know that.
He's pretty awesome. But no, Matt adds a really good dynamic with Sasich, because he and Sasich are equal on the talent plane, I think. Matt's a lot younger, and so he'll bring it, and he's going to bring it to the nth degree. But Sasich and he can play off of one another. A lot of leads you hear, there are two or three leads going on, and in the show we intertwine those leads, and you can hear one going, they go back and forth with one another. And he's added that, he's added depth to it, which is really cool. Like I said, the classic rock thing for me, I like bands like Thin Lizzy, you know, where there was between the two guitar players, or Iron Maiden, where there between the two guitar players there's that big dynamic of being able to not only do the riffs and all that, but then rip a lead with one another or separately, and each one of them's good. And if you put one in one speaker and one in the other, they're each dynamic in their own way, which is great. To get to have Matt, I've been particular about with the band members, and I won't play with anybody else besides this lineup, I don't think, anymore. I mean, I'm too old anyway, I don't want to start all over again, but it's been great to get to know these guys and let them go at each other and come up with something creative. And I want it to get bigger, you know. Now it seems like we've got it dialed in, now let's make it bigger and fuller and just, you know, keep adding to it and get a little more self-indulgent. We've been stripped down for 12 years, let's tune it up and be a little self-indulgent to be funny. I mean, you can be tongue-in-cheek and be self-indulgent and not be egotistical about it and still make music that people enjoy, I think, you know, and that's what we're pushing towards, I believe.
I think you've reached that with this album. Yeah, I can't wait to see what's next for you guys. We'll get to that in just a moment, but I wanted to touch briefly on what made you guys choose Sri Whipple, the local artist for the cover art.
Oh, he's a badass.
Yeah.
His artwork, just the surreal element of it, it looks like he took the same drugs that I took when I was younger. So he gets it. When I look at his stuff, I just go, yeah, I know you. You know, when I met him, we were common thread drunkards, and I'm like, I know you. You know, just to see what he does and how he paints. And like I said, local talent, it abounds. There are so many folks here that can do stuff like that. What other place can you just go and show up and say, hey, listen to this album, and can you do a record for us? And he comes up with this thing that looks like Robert Williams and Coop had a baby and made a painting, and it's amazing, and he knocked it out, and knocked it out of the park for me, you know, for what I expected. I didn't know what to expect when he was going to do it, but retroactively, I didn't know how many record covers he had done, but retroactively, I've kind of seen what he's done, and yeah, he always knocks it out of the park, no matter what, in each subject matter. He gets the band, he listens to the band, he knows what's going on with it. And when I bought the painting from him of the record cover, and I ended up buying three other pieces from him because it was like, you know, and I'm not an art, do I look like an art collector? I'm a redneck weirdo, you know?
Yeah, but I might say no.
I was like, I want to buy these three because they work with, I want all of it, but dude, this kills it. And and I respect him a lot for his craft and for his art and what he's got in his crazy head, and it's a mutual thing, you know, so that's good. He's a good friend.
It definitely works with the theme and tone of the album, yeah, for sure. What's next for you guys?
Work, just like, you know, promotion, playing some shows, doing some touring, and then piecing together, you know, riffs and ideas and trying to put together another album, I think. I don't want there to be that big of a gap like there was with this one. We had some internal issues and we've moved beyond that. So now it's like just that work, which that's what it is being in a band. Mm-hmm. And a lot of work, and the payoff is you get to entertain your friends and have a good time, you know.
We're about to play the track Hit the Bottle Again. Okay. Can you talk a little bit about recording the drums for that, Eric? Your experience?
I don't know. I think I was pretty hammered when we did it. So I barely even remember it.
That's exactly the answer I was hoping for.
Yeah, well, they did that to me too. Mike has the recording studio right by Piper Down.
Oh,
and
that's true.
And Willie's. We're between Willie's and Piper Down, which Willie's is our hometown bar, and Piper Down's in a pinch. But we could go back and forth, and like the all fucked up backup stuff, I was really all fucked up, and they just let me scream in the studio because it's like a show. I just get to get all jacked up and run around, and you know, so I'm in the studio doing that, and I didn't know Mike was recording it. I was just listening to it and screaming it, and then it worked out, you know, and like there's a really terrible yell in the middle, which is funny, and like there's just a bunch of madness going on in that song, which pretty much reflects a Night at a Thunderfist show, I think. I think it pretty much.
And an apt title.
Yeah, it's
I would
an apt
say.
Title, yeah.
Here's Hit the Bottle Again off that new album, the self-titled album from Thunderfist. Thanks for joining us, guys.
Oh, thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
That was Thunderfist with Hit the Bottle Again off their new self-titled album. To purchase it for just $10, look up Thunderfist on cdbaby.com. And for more information on the band and upcoming dates, check them out at facebook.com/thunderfistslc. Cannibal Corpse is a death metal band from Buffalo, New York, who originally formed in 1988. They formed from three demised metal bands. The group has been building a successful cult following ever since without much radio or television exposure. The periodically changing lineup currently includes Alex Webster on bass, Rob Barrett and Patrick O'Brien on guitar, Paul Mazurkiewicz on drums, and George Fisher on vocals. In March of 2012, the band released Torture, their 12th studio album. Slug writer Henry Glasheen recently spoke with Mazurkiewicz about the album.
The writing process for Cannibal Corpse, could you go back into that and give me a little more detail on it? Specifically, like, who writes the music and how it kind of gets put together?
Well, yeah, like I said, when we started writing, had these ideas, and me and him just basically got together to kind of get the songs. But, we got three main songwriters in the band, being Rob, Pat, and Alex.
Yeah.
And Alex has written a lot of material over the years for Cannibal, you know, probably the most out of any member ever kind of a thing. It's just great. He's got some great songs. He's a great writer. You know, but of course, when we can have diversity at any given point, it's a great thing. You know, the more diverse, the better, the way we look at it, because, like I said, we do got two other great writers. But everybody writes, of course, differently. I mean, it seems pretty much done individually these days. You know, Alex will be writing his songs at home in his home studio, doing all the work on the computer and tabbing it out and doing all the, you know, arrangement, putting down drum tracks from a drum machine just to, you know, having pretty much a song done where we can kind of learn it as musicians. Here's the music, here's the guitar parts, all that kind of stuff, which is, you know, if that's the way he wants to get done and do his thing, that's, you know, teach their own. And that really helps us, of course, to be able to understand and learn the songs, that he's able to do all those things. But Rob's starting to kind of dabble into that more writing like that way, at least getting putting the riffs down to, you know, to like the click track or maybe even some basic drum patterns on a drum machine. He did that with one of his songs, but on the new record, the Sarcophagic Frenzy, he did that for. But then his other two was kind of a little more conventional, just coming up with the riffs, old school style. Me and him get together, kind of work on the arrangement a little bit, what fits, what don't, with the, you know, kind of beats and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, we got his other two songs kind of done that way. And Pat, very similar in the way he writes. He's not too much in the technical aspect of, you know, sitting down and writing, say, the way Alex is doing at all. He's more of, you know, just making the riffs and kind of, you know, just keep practicing them himself, making a song that way to where he might have four or five riffs and they're already kind of complete and put together, knowing what he wants to do. It's just a matter of working out the proper, you know, the proper drum beats as well.
Yeah.
And me and him might just get together and kind of like form the song to a completion in that way, even though he's already had, you know, a good 60, 50, 75% of it completed, you know. So that's kind of the way we're at for the, you know, for the writing, you know, with the music. And it's just great to have that diversity, because the way everybody is going to, of course, is going to have write differently, and the way they write, you know, it's all, you know, whatever, you know, as long as it gets done. But man, just having three great songwriters, and I should add, on for me personally as well, having Rob and Pat contribute a little bit more, say, than on the last record,
mm-hmm.
Is a great thing. But I think that they both wrote, you know, the best songs they ever written for Cannibal. I mean, I think Rob's three are just typical pure Cannibal, and I think they're the best three songs that he's ever written out of any of the songs he's written for us in the past. And Pat as well. I mean, Pat's written some great stuff over the years, but man, I don't know why these songs just have a little bit more feel to them, and I'm really happy the way they turned out. So I think we just, you know, got a great diverse album with everybody contributing and it being the, you know, the best that they can be, you know. So
yeah, and it helps that they can communicate ideas so efficiently throughout the band, you know, because
right.
Then the songs get written a lot more efficiently.
Yeah, that's what we're trying to do. I think as time goes by, we try to be as efficient as possible, you know,
mm-hmm.
and try to do, you know, and through experience and what have you, of just, you know, trying to write a better song and of course communicating as much as we can to, you know, to be able to make it work as smooth as possible.
I still see but this part over my head.
What inspired your interest in gore lyrics? I mean, I know you guys are really into horror films and all that stuff, so...
Well, I mean, you know, back when we started, it all stems from, of course, back in, you know, when we grew up kind of thing. You know, we're products of the 80s kind of, mm-hmm. you know, music scene, growing with, you know, the scene in a sense, you know, when our first bands were hearing the brand new Metallica and Slayer and all that kind of stuff in the early 80s. And, you know, it was bands like that taking, you know, metal to a different level and making it more aggressive and more, you know, kind of evil in a way, you know, and the subject matter was getting darker then because the music was getting darker and more intense. So, of course, our favorite bands, you know, growing up were Slayer and Creator and Sodom and, you know, I mean, anything that was, you know, brutal in our eyes like that. But, of course, what are they writing about? They're writing about dark subject matters. It's all about, you know, the macabre things, and a lot of them have to do with death and, you know, women's and things like that. So, I mean, it was just, to us, it always just went hand in hand, you know, with that kind of music. And then here we, you know, come a few years later, and we're able to make a band, you know, and be fortunate enough to get signed and all that kind of a thing. And, you know, we wanted to make music that and have see albums and listen and look at albums that we as fans wanted to see, I guess, at that time. But obviously, I guess I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself on that, because, you know, when the band was formed, I guess the name of the band is going to be a big reason why we're going to be writing what we do right as well, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, when we ended up coming up with that name, and that was Alex, it was like, I don't know if he was really, you know, he was into all that kind of stuff, but I mean, when you're really solidifying a band name like that, well, what else can it be about? You know, it's going to be about the horror and macabre and zombies and crazy stuff like that, because it goes hand in hand with a name like Cannibal Corpse, you know. And I think that was kind of, it sold us on the sense of, well, we know what we're going to be really themed about more, you know, because we do enjoy these subject matters,
yeah.
You know, exactly, the movies and stuff like that. It wasn't like they were ruling our lives, you know, like, oh my God, we're just such huge horror buffs. You know, we are in the sense of we're teenagers growing up, loving that kind of genre, seeing movies and reading books like that, and, you know, being interested in, you know, the music that we're listening to is all about dark subject matter. So, you know, so then when we come up with the name Cannibal Corpse, well, then it's like, well, of course we got to be about this kind of stuff, you know. So, and like, now we're a band that can able to, you know, put music and visuals out there and lyrics that we want to see as fans, taking it to another level, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what we really, you know, we did. We wanted to put out music and, you know, like I said, that we wanted to see as fans, and we're just moving forward on that ever since, you know, the band's been started. So.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, the lyrical subject just never seems to change, but it's never a bad thing, because I mean, a lot of death metal bands, they'll go off and they'll have a political or an anti-religious phase, and
right,
you guys are
right.
Like, nope, we're just going to stick with the gore.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, we know we're kind of pigeonholed, but we love that. That's, you know, that's our challenge in a sense, is to do something a little bit different at least. You know, sure, the subject matter ain't going to change much, you know. It's just a lot of it is how you go about things and how you might write things. Things, you know, using just little subtleties that might not be very apparent, but to us it's huge, you know.
Yeah.
And just come up with some cool things that we feel that we haven't come up with in the past, and I think we seem to tend to do that every release, so, you know.
So looking back, how do you feel about the direction that Cannibal Corpse has taken over the years? Like, do you feel like it's been living up to your original expectations for the band?
I mean, there's really never been any expectations other than, you know, just play music we love to play, and that, and we never looked more forward than that kind of thing, you know, since day one.
Yeah.
You know, because you're just setting out to make a band that, you know, you're playing music you like to play with your friends and having a great time, you know, and then anything else beyond that is a perk, and if things happen, that's great, but, you know, you can't really go out thinking anything. I mean, I guess we just evolved. It was just, you know, yeah, I would say I'm 100% happy with everything, because, you know, to get to this point, all these things needed to occur, and we're just musicians. We're just trying to better ourselves as musicians every year, and every year is a different story and a different attitude or what have you, you know, a different maturity level or whatever, things just progressing in that way, the way life goes, you know. So we've always just given it our best at any given time kind of thing, and you know, it's just weird, I guess, that it took 20 say years for us to be on top of our game, I guess, maybe just honing our skills and you know, maturing or whatever you want to call it, getting wiser, you're getting older, and you know, mentally maybe you're on top of it more so than ever because you're older. I don't know, I can't explain it fully, but I guess it just you know, we just, like I said, never looked any forward than the present, and you know, the fact that we're still around this day, 23 and, you know, going on 24 years, and yeah, you would have to look back and go, well, you know, to get to this point, you know, to be where we're at, you know, a lot of good things obviously has happened to us, and we must have been doing the right things, so, you know, I wouldn't change anything, and, you know, and we're great, it's happy, you know, it's a happy place, it's a great place. I'm very appreciative of what has become of the band and anything, you know, that we get from the band, because it's a dream come true, and still remarkable to me times thinking, exactly, been around this long, it's like, you know, would have never ever believed or guessed that, you know, never in a million years back then.
Oh, yeah, I mean, like, there was a long time when you guys were facing a lot of, like, censorship and persecution for, you know, having the lyrical themes that you had, having the album artwork that you had, and I think they had you remove a lot of your lyrics from censored versions of the album. Like, it seems like you guys are finally able to dictate the course of the band nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, we're going to deal with that over our, you know, our career, and a lot of bands do. I guess the most important thing for us was always the same thing, the music. You know,
yeah.
As long as the people can get the music. I mean, it's unfortunate if they're going to censor the cover and maybe you can't get the lyrics, and, you know, but this day and age it can be obtained, you know. I mean, with the internet now, you know, if something's banned, you know, chances are you'll be able to obtain it, get it in some other manner, which is good, because that couldn't happen back in the day, you know. It would have been a lot harder for that for people to obtain things. But, you know, we've always just done our thing, you know, and just, you know, we kind of shrugged it aside. Anything that happens to us was always ridiculous in that sense. You know, like I said, as long as the fans are getting the music, that's the most important thing. But we just stuck true to what we believe in and what we haven't done anything different. And, you know, we were able to, exactly, you know, the censorship has eased up a lot, you know. It's definitely not what it was, you know, 10, 15 years ago and all this. So, you know, like I said, we just do our thing and, you know, we can't be stopped. So, but, you know, it, like I said, it's not up to us. If it's unfortunate, if things are going to get censored, then so be it. And, you know, it's just, I'm glad it's, you know, not like it used to be, you know, where it's that bad. But yeah, it hasn't stopped us. Well, you know, here we are, 23 years, so, you know, 12 albums, you know, we're not going anywhere.
To read more from this interview, check out the Cannibal Corpse article posted earlier this month on Napalm Flesh, located on slugmag.com. And for more information on the group, as well as their current tour, visit them at cannibalcorpse.net. And action. Thanks, Josh, for starting us. We are joined today by Ricky Vigil.
Hi.
And Joshua Joy.
Hello.
Thank you, guys. You're both excited, I can tell, about doing the weekly daily calendar rundown.
I'm way excited that you just got the right name for that.
I read it right there. It's on the thing, so
that okay. Would be his computer he's pointing to.
Yeah. This is an audio medium, JP, not visual.
Thank you for the lesson, guys. I'm glad we got some experts here.
Yeah.
Speaking of, do you guys want to start us off, since you know what's going on?
Yeah, go ahead, Josh.
Oh, so on Tuesday, April 24th, we have, once again, Dr. Sketchy's Space Girl Adventure. It's at the Metro. I've never been to that personally. I've been always told to go, so maybe if I have time, I will.
I want to go. Do you want to go, Josh?
Yeah, I'm down. I know how much you love drawing.
Yeah.
So.
Dr. Sketchy's, for you guys who don't know, is this cool kind of... I think they built as an anti-art school. You go and people dress up in weird costumes. This one seems like it's a space theme. And you do figure drawing and you get to drink. So that seems pretty rad. I think I'm going to go to this one.
Yeah, if I have time, like I said, I'll probably go as well. What about you, JP?
You're going to have to count me out on this one, guys.
Why?
I'm not an artist.
You can just come and get drunk.
Okay, I can do that.
All right.
And I don't have to wear a costume?
Yeah, you're a Viking.
You can if you want. You can be a space Viking.
Thanks for that suggestion, guys. I'll be there.
Okay, do you want to tell us what's going on Wednesday, Ricky?
Yeah, so on Wednesday, April 25th, there is an all-local pop and indie rock show at Urban Lounge. We've got The Swinging Lights, Lady Murasaki, New Body Electric, and Watches. Do you guys know of any of these bands?
I have no idea, actually.
We played Lady Murasaki recently on the podcast.
We have a review of a Lady Murasaki album in our April issue, actually.
So read that, and if you like how it sounds, head into Urban Lounge on the 25th. Friday, we've got some good news, the good word, as it were, but it's not about Jesus.
No, it's about Katie Panzer, because it's her birthday.
Happy birthday!
Yeah, Katie's a writer and photographer at Slug. She is pretty rad.
That was a really good Astaire impersonation and or singing number there, Josh.
Oh,
will you do that
you.
For all the birthdays?
Probably not.
Ah, shit. We'll just do what you feel like it when it comes time.
Yeah, we have some more birthdays coming up, so think about that.
Yeah. So what else is going on that Friday?
We also have, from the Utah Symphony, Mozart's Requiem. Requiem. How do you say that?
Requiem.
Requiem. All right, I was pretty close.
You were right on.
All right. Well, that's happening for 2 days, Friday and Saturday, I assume, at Bravenel Hall.
That's
you
correct.
Guys think so?
And you can get tickets via 355 ARTS. That's Artix.
Yeah.
Or Utah Symphony, Utah Opera, and it starts promptly at 8 p.m. There is a lecture ahead of the performance in the main hall. I believe that starts at 7 or 7:15. Admission is free with your ticket. You get to talk to the conductor sometimes and guest artists. And they do a Q&A occasionally. It's really, really interesting.
Cool. That sounds classy.
Yeah.
That's what you would use to describe it. And the best news of the whole week is that Sunday, April 29th, is a birthday bonanza.
That's exactly what I would say.
I would say a triple hitter.
Wow. I might say birthday explosion.
Okay.
I like all those.
Yeah.
Both all those. Who wants to start the birthdays?
First off, we have our writer, Brian Kubarish. Happy birthday, Brian.
Happy birthday.
We also have another one of our writers, and he does some stuff with the Slug Games, Chris Proctor.
Happy birthday.
And last but not least, our podcast producer, office coordinator, occasional writer, man about town, some would call him the king of the underground, Gavin Sheehan.
Happy birthday, Gavin!
Thanks to Stare. Wow, Stare joined in. I didn't think she would.
Thank you!
All right, I think that's enough fun for this week.
Yep, we certainly did a good job wrapping up the weekly daily calendar rundown, but we do have to explain what that is in general and where people can find it and where they can find it on the app. Who wants to do that?
I think you should. You're the most knowledgeable, JP.
On that specifically, I'd like to point out.
Yeah.
Because I've done it so much. Well, you can find us in the back of the magazine, the weekly daily calendar rundown. You can also find it online on the front page of slugmag.com. It's also available via the Slugmag app, which you can get in iTunes if you have an iPhone. I think that's pretty much all the places you can find it. And, of course, here on the podcast every week.
Yeah, and if you have any daily calendar dates, you should send them to dailycalendar@slugmag.com before the 25th of every month. And that way we can get your info into the issue, maybe onto the podcast, and everywhere else that you can find our daily calendar.
That's a good point. I'm glad you're here, Ricky, because I don't know these sorts of details. That's really good. People sometimes ask me how they get on. I say, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm here to teach.
We just had a teachable moment.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. We also should mention what you guys do for the magazine as well.
I'm the contributing editor, and I do interviews and music reviews. You have probably heard my voice on this podcast. I know you have, JP.
And you'll be a part of an upcoming Napalm Flesh roundtable where we talk about best of metal albums.
Yeah, our most influential metal albums that's coming up.
That'll be really cool. And Josh, what do you do for the paper?
Oh, I am the issue designer. Head, actually.
Lead designer.
Lead designer, if there you will. Go.
Occasional podcast contributor.
Yeah, there's that.
Thanks so much for joining me, guys. You did a really good job. Thanks. I am surprised.
Thank you.
Still C is a post-hardcore punk band from Salt Lake City. The group is made up of members of SLC doom punk group Gunner and SLC punk band Storming Stages and Stereos. They came together to record a 5-track EP called Palms Open to the Firmament, released in February of 2012. Here's their song Winter Sting from the debut EP. Yeah! That was Winter Sting from Still Sea. That EP is currently on sale at a price you name at stillsea.bandcamp.com. For more info on the group, visit them at facebook.com/stillsea.slc. Matt Bruce is a Utah native who has been working since 2011 as an assistant campaigner for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA, the largest animal rights organization in the world. He now resides in Los Angeles and travels around North America organizing and leading demonstrations in an effort to educate people on animal cruelty, eliminate animal abuse in factory farms, laboratories, and the clothing and entertainment industries. Slug editorial assistant Esther Moronio spoke to Bruce over the phone about his history, his present and future with animal rights advocacy.
Tell me a little bit about your job and what your position is exactly and what your job consists of.
Well, I'm an assistant campaigner for PETA, organize and lead demonstrations across the country, and I talk to reporters about animal rights. My main focus is Ringling Brothers, so I pretty much follow the circus around and base tours around what cities they're going to be in. I talk to people about their horrific treatment of elephants and other animals. I work on other campaigns too, like animal testing, furs, animals in factory farms, vegetarianism. I spend about 2 to 3 weeks a month on the road.
I know that when you first started working there, you had to go through kind of extensive training. So is the job that you have now the job that you applied for, or is that something that they kind of fit you in based on your skills and all of that?
This is the job that I applied for. I've been going to demos for pretty much since I became vegan. So for the past 10 years, I've had experience working on the streets and talking to people about veganism. And then for a few years, I was touring with Cherim, who is a vegan straight edge band, hardcore band from Salt Lake City. And I would talk to people at their shows about veganism and hand out literature and just talk to them about animal rights, show them videos and stuff. And, you know, we would be going from town to town and in a van that had problems. Sometimes we didn't always have a place to stay. Had to like copy my literature at like a Kinko's. And now I'm basically doing the same thing. I still get to travel, but PETA takes very good care of me, so I don't need to worry about cars breaking down or copying things at Kinko's last minute or anything. It's really nice. But I mean, like I was doing it for free as a volunteer for so long. I thought I'd try my hand at it professionally.
Being a part of PETA now, you've had a chance to travel to a lot of different places. Like you said, you're on the road 2 to 3 weeks out of the month, and you're pretty involved in the organization of the protests and demonstrations, right?
Yeah, that is my job. I organize and lead the demos all across the country, and even up in even down into Mexico and up into Canada, doing everything that we can to make these demonstrations very sensational and newsworthy, and then we get the press out and we're able to have a larger platform to talk about these animal issues. Sometimes we can organize demos that last an hour, and with media attention we can reach, you know, tens of thousands of people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a wonderful thing.
So what have been some of your favorite demonstrations that you've organized and been a part of?
Recently I went down to Mexico to do a bullfighting demo. They had about 1,200 people in front of the Independence Angel in downtown Mexico City. It's like one of the largest monuments they have. And there were a few hundred people on the stairs, on the steps, like all holding signs. And then stretched for blocks, there were about 1,000 people, more or less naked. I mean, they had black bottoms, the girls had like flesh colored tops on, and all covered in fake blood, and they had the barbed sticks that they drive into bulls' backs. They had mock-ups of those in their backs, and then they all marched in and they all laid down in front of the statue. And so it was really amazing with over 1,200 people there, and just all these people like lying down covered in fake blood, talking about addressing the issue of like what these bulls go through and how inhumane and cruel it is. And now it's about one step away from being bullfighting is one step away from being banned in Mexico City. The result of all the actions that these people out there have been doing have finally produced something worthwhile, you know.
You were telling me that you talk to reporters a lot, so I kind of wanted to test some of your press skills and go over some arguments that you've probably heard a lot. So I know that a lot of people, vegans and non-vegans and non-vegetarians, who kind of think that PETA's methods are a little too over the top and that they might drive people away rather than make the vegetarian and vegan cause appealing. So what do you say to those people?
Well, PETA tries to push animal rights in the mainstream in every possible, in every conceivable direction. We have PETA Prime for people over 60. We've got PETA Kids for children. We push a lot of our sexy campaigns. We've got our spay and neuter trucks that go across the country, and we're trying to push this in every conceivable direction to reach as many people as possible, because the animals deserve to be understood, and they deserve our voice to be out there and trying to fight for them in any way that we can.
Okay, so you don't think that maybe some of the methods are, because, you know, like I was saying, it's really hard to change people's minds about things, and sometimes when you're so in your face with them, they get more defensive than understanding. So are you saying that you have campaigns that kind of cater towards those people as well?
See, it also really depends on what the media wants to pick up. Sometimes they only pick up our more sensational ones, and we love doing these sensational demos. They're a lot of fun. They're fun for the people involved. People get a kick out of it when they see it on the street, and it opens us up to be to talk about animal rights on a major platform.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have smaller ones. We have debates that we organize with universities across the country, right to companies. We call on our supporters to talk to their legislator, to talk to their senators, and sign petitions and everything. We do as much as we can in every direction that we can.
That makes complete sense, that the media would just pick up all the really crazy ones.
Yeah, exactly.
There are some people who see PETA's campaigns as maybe sexist and exploitive of women because of the nudity involved. And what do you say to those people? Why do you guys use those types of demonstrations?
Our volunteers participate in these demonstrations of their own free will. They want to take part in it. If they see that this is a way that they can help animals, to bring attention to the billions of animals who suffer on factory farms every year, it's up to them to do that. These animals deserve a voice, and the suffering that they go through doesn't compare to the suffering that is going on when these girls are on street corners and they're handing out literature, like in the cold or whatever. The first time I did a demonstration with one of our lettuce ladies was in Washington, D.C. last January. It was really amazing because we were handing out, on average, 3 vegetarian starter kits a minute, and it wasn't even that busy of a sidewalk. And I had never seen people pick up literature so quickly as I did with that. So it's really amazing how much we can, how many people we reach, and how much attention we get when we do that. But like I said, also we do other things that just don't get media coverage. You know, I've been in front of slaughterhouses with men and women like wrapped up in plastic, resembling meat trays covered in fake blood. I've been elementary schools with a big parrot mascot with a sign that says, "Eat your veggies, not your friends," and handing out coloring books to children. I've been outside of the circus with people in elephant costumes, and outside of shoe conventions with people in cow costumes talking about leather.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes these things just don't get, the media doesn't come out for them, and then mm-hmm. we can't talk about this issue in the public eye like we can sometimes when we're able to have these willing volunteers participate in doing something that might involve, like, you know, a woman in a bikini or a bearskin don't wear skin campaign.
Going into these demonstrations, I mean, it's really hard to change people's minds about things, obviously, especially when diet is such a big part of culture, and, you know, bullfighting is a big part of land culture. So do you go into these demonstrations kind of thinking, oh, you know, maybe what we're going to do today isn't going to do much, or do you have, like, a very specific goals, and I guess how do you measure your success?
We can measure our success by the amount of literature that we're able to hand out, the amount of people we get through to, getting picked up the media and seeing how many people we can reach. I mean, it's a new generation, it's a new era. People are thinking about things differently. Consciousness is progressing to a more compassionate state. People are thinking about where their food comes from. They're thinking about the suffering that it causes. The amount of people who were against bullfighting were polled against. The people supporting the anti-bullfighting cause increased. So there are more and more people standing up against bullfighting. In fact, the majority of people in Mexico and in Spain don't, they want to do away with bullfighting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's getting outlawed in different cities, and it's outlawed in many places around the world, like the United States. The amount of people that are coming to these protests, I mean, I remember going to see Ringling Brothers when I was a kid and not seeing protesters outside.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I first started to go into circus protests like 10 years ago, we'd have like maybe 20 or 30 people. And now here I am 10 years later. I'm here in L.A., and there were 500 people at a circus protest standing up for these elephants.
Wow.
And it's really amazing. I mean, people are just learning more, and the walls are breaking down, and they're seeing the kind of suffering that goes into these things. Whenever we find that animals are used to turn a profit, or they're used for entertainment, that corners are cut when it comes to animal welfare. We'd like to see them out of these horrific conditions.
How has working for PETA changed your own perception of animal rights thus far? Or has it at all? Has it just kind of fueled the fire?
Yeah, working for PETA has definitely fueled the fire more. I'm much more of a lean, mean animal rights machine now. working so hard, doing multiple demos a week, and sometimes doing multiple demos a day, talking to people about animal rights keeps me sharp. And it reminds me why I'm here, what I'm doing, and how important this information is, how real this struggle is, and how much animals really suffer. The question isn't how smart they are or how much we can relate to them, but it really is how much they suffer, because these animals experience fear and terror just like we do, and they don't want to die, and forcing them to become food on our plate or whipped and broken and forced to learn unnatural tricks in the circus, or being the victim of painfully invasive procedures in some animal experimenter's lab is completely unethical.
If people want to get involved with PETA or just get involved in animal rights here in Salt Lake, what do you suggest they do?
Well, I suggest that they visit our website, PETA.org, or they can write an email to our action team at actionteam@PETA.org to find out when PETA will be in town doing demonstrations around Salt Lake City or wherever anybody's from. And also to get involved with UARC, the Utah Animal Rights Coalition, which is the local group in Salt Lake City who's doing a really amazing thing. There is a Facebook group called SLC Vegans, and I believe the Utah Animal Rights Coalition, or UARC, is also on Facebook.
For more information on PETA, visit their website at PETA.org. To get involved on a local level, find the Utah Animal Rights Coalition on Facebook, along with the Facebook group SLC Vegan. Thanks for listening to another edition of Sound Waves from the Underground. For all things Slug Magazine, visit slugmag.com. What was the first comic book that you ever read? Do you remember any memorable titles that got you interested in comic books or characters you still love to this day? Please send an email to soundwaves@slugmag.com or call and leave us a message on our automated voicemail line with answers to our questions at 858-233-9324. We may just play you on the show. On next week's episode, we're going to be finding out about Craft Lake City, Tour de Bruta, and Free Comic Book Day. This podcast was created by Slug Magazine and is produced by Gavin Sheehan with associate producers Jeanette D. Moses, Ricky Vigil, Esther Moronio, and Jonathan Paxton. Our executive producer is Angela H. Brown. Our theme was performed by Birthquake and recorded by Jesse Ellis. Our main logo and art design is by T. Doan, with technical design by Kate O'Connor. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week.